Argument now in the case of Blythe Holdings against De Angelis.
Good morning, Judge Bauer. Good morning, Judge Easterbrook. Good morning, Judge Williams. We're here as a result of what I view as an error by the district court. I believe the case law in Illinois also shows an error by the district court in granting summary judgment on legal malpractice claims and unjust enrichment claims against the defendant, and I believe the record substantially shows the egregious conduct they engaged in. The unjust enrichment took place as a matter of law in Illinois. The defendants contend that the fees which my client paid were never tendered up the chain of command, so to speak, for Brown, Udell, and Pomerantz, but that's meaningless. Under Illinois law, an old case called Germania Life Insurance from 1897, but it's still good law. The moment my client issued that check, pursuant to a retainer agreement, there is no dispute that this retainer agreement was signed on Brown, Udell, and Pomerantz's documents by their authorized agent, Mr. De Angelis, and my client issued a check at that point. Under Germania, that money went to Brown, Udell, Pomerantz at the moment it was tendered. There is no dispute in Illinois law. The defendant's position that we didn't get it or it didn't go up the chain of command is irrelevant. The other issue, Judge, is that under Illinois,
I think their position really is that there was no evidence that the firm authorized De Angelis to keep the money himself, and so there's some problem with this constructive receipt theory you have.
Well, whether they authorize him to keep it themselves or he's supposed to split it and give them half is a matter of law in Illinois. When he received the funds, they got the funds. That's what Germania says. In that case, the company, like here, tried to deny receipt of information. They said our agent wasn't empowered to do that. Our agent should not have taken that information. What the court said is that's your agent. And actually, Judge, that would show why at summary judgment this should not have been granted, because it's in dispute. That's their defense. But the evidence is that De Angelis had the authority to enter into this agreement, and he so testified.
In this agreement, there was a $25,000 retainer fee, and we've held that the remedy of unjust enrichment is not available when a claim falls within an express contract. How is your unjust enrichment claim even viable when the attorney-client relationship was governed by the retainer agreement?
Because under Illinois law, it does recognize the concept, both legally and equitable, of unjust enrichment, and that it's the transfer of the money, Judge. It's not just the relationship. Here, the relationship defines give us the money, and they do. It's the receipt of those funds. And then the question this court has to ask itself is that under concepts of justice, equity, and good conscience, should they be allowed to keep that money? And the suggestion that they got no benefit is not accurate. They had a $100,000 business relationship with De Angelis that allowed him to engage in this. If they have a dispute over that money, they have a right to sue him to get their half of the money. That's their business relationship. That should allow disgorgement of those funds from the $100,000-plus they have made. But I think this has to be decided under Illinois law. That's the real question. And under Illinois law, there is no dispute that they actually received those money.
I had one other question I was curious about. Why did Blythe continue paying money to De Angelis and Williams after it became clear that the $150,000 to Williams in November and the $250,000 paid to De Angelis in December were not used to pay for the lots?
I think the best term I could use is sheer panic. They had investors. They had people who wanted to see this project go forward, and they kept to be continued. I think the record is replete with assurances they received from both the alderperson, from Blythe and Flawless, and from De Angelis, the law firm, that they would be able to succeed. That actually raises a very interesting point, Your Honor. It's the $250,000 that's transferred. For some reason, the district court did not view that as some type of discrete or separate act of malpractice for which we can recover, but there's no contrary evidence. The evidence of the expert of Professor Gross is that that transfer violated the standard of care, and of course it would. You have a duty when you took the money into your trust account to make sure it was being transferred for the purchase of deeds. That's what the client thought. In effect, he transferred money to somebody who couldn't perform, and they are out $250,000. It is somewhat inconceivable to be able to say that that is not an act of malpractice. At this point, it's uncontested that that was an act of malpractice. So what's the causation, the but-for, which I'm going to address on the other issues, but for that wrongful transfer, that $250,000 would still be in the possession of my clients and available for other aspects of the project. One of the tacks the defendants took, and the court, I think, accepted, was the fact that they raised additional money somehow eliminated that act of malpractice, but it doesn't. The loss is there. It is separate. It is discreet. It is clearly visible. I think the larger issue is that the court, as a matter of law, decided causation in a legal malpractice case where Illinois law specifically states, and this court has accepted that, that that is for the trier of fact, that these are debatable facts, debatable issues. And this case is a perfect example. You have conduct by the defendants before they're sued, where they enter into a written agreement and they make promises. And that's what we would show for causation. We don't have to show we would be absolutely successful. What we have to convince a trier of fact is that it's more likely true than not than we would have succeeded. How do we do that? We hired experts. That's what we would tell the jury. We hired people who claimed that they had done this before successfully. They were, unfortunately, in contravention of the rules of ethics. They are also representing somebody else at the same time, claiming they could do this, that they could be successful. Those are admissions by the defendant. It's also conduct, which at the point of summary judgment, the court has to give us those inferences that they hired the right people. According to the agreement, we would have sub-consultants and subcontractors that they would hire to assure that this application process went through and that we would be successful. In addition to admissions, the argument you would make, and it's why summary judgment should have been denied, is that that's their conduct. If they now want to say, hey, wait, this was folly, they were never going to succeed, there's no evidence in the record that they ever told their clients that. What they told their clients is, you're going to be successful, you will succeed, and we will hire all the necessary people. And in addition to that, for causation, because at one point the defendant said, you'll never make it through the city council, you have all those hoops. Well, as a matter of law in Illinois, you couldn't dismiss on that basis. There are very limited times when legal malpractice cases don't go to a jury. A situation like this, where you're claiming malpractice in an appeal, we leave it to the courts to decide. But here, the question is, could we have been successful? And we would marshal the evidence that we already had the alderwoman in that ward who had successfully done this before, marshaling our project through the city council, assisting us, knowing what it would take. So we had that. We had the right lawyers. We hired an architect who was an expert in all this area, and he did the work for us. So that would be more than enough, and certainly the inferences at this point is that we had the horsepower to complete the deal. And
that's back to this $250,000, you said it was panic as it related to the investors, why they went on and paid it. But couldn't Blythe have used that money from Investor 4 to continue the venture, either by fixing the application to Nolan or starting an application with HUD?
No, Your Honor. And the undisputed evidence is this, that after the application was ruined, after the $250,000 was transferred, and then the application was kicked out because he applied to the wrong place and it would take another year, the undisputed evidence is at that point the investors fled. Blythe tried to get additional investors but could not. And those are the facts in the record at this time. That what caused the investors to leave and to end the project was the fact of the continuous mistakes, not just the transfer of the $250,000, but the another year delay. And in real estate and in low-income housing, time was of the essence. So once that happened, they lose their ability to continue. And that's the inference the court has to draw at this time. There is no contrary evidence. And so with that, I think the court has to say, yes, there is causation here. They could not continue. And the defendants will not be able to point to any testimony that says they could continue. It's undisputed at this point. So the only inference is that the malpractice, excuse me, is what caused this to fall apart. The last part the district court did was say that we could not demonstrate against the corporate defendant why that we needed an expert to say that they did not properly supervise. That is not the law in Illinois. The law in Illinois is that if it's open and careless activity, they will not require a professional expert opinion. We believe we had that. We had the general manager testifying that that he was unsupervised, that they engaged in malpractice. I think that would be enough. But from the Frito case and the other cases we cited, the fact that there is evidence that he wasn't supervised at all, under Illinois law, the court can take judicial notice of 5.1, which requires the firm to supervise him and make sure the client is being delivered the product. So with judicial notice of that fact, and if all the evidence is he was unsupervised, we would fall into the exception in Illinois that would allow us to go. My white light is on, so if there are no additional questions, whatever's left I will address in my
mm-hmm. Thank you, Mr. Tobin.
Thank you.
Mr. Redberg.
Good morning. May it please the court, Kyle Redberg, along with my partner, Terry Weissman, on behalf of defendants appellants Brownie Dell and Pomerantz and the individual named partners of that firm. Illinois courts have long imposed a very specific requirement for demonstrating causation in a legal malpractice case. In particular, a plaintiff must prove that but for the attorney's negligence, plaintiff would have prevailed in the underlying action. That requirement is well established in Illinois case law, including in the Lowry case, which is the only proximate cause case cited in plaintiff's brief, and has been repeatedly acknowledged by this court, including in the Bork decision cited in our brief and the Mihaljevic decision cited by the district court in its opinion. Illinois courts have also specifically addressed how that basic requirement translates into the context of an engagement such as this one here that related to a transaction. And those courts have held that a legal malpractice plaintiff asserting a claim arising out of such an engagement must show that but for the attorney's malpractice, the client would have been successful in the undertaking the attorney was retained to perform. Here, the undertaking that attorney John DeAngelis was retained to perform related to the acquisition of lots from the city of Chicago. Because plaintiffs failed to bring forth any evidence that they would have successfully acquired the lots from the city, absent some act of legal malpractice by Mr. DeAngelis, the district court properly entered summary judgment against plaintiffs on their legal malpractice claims.
You know, I asked counsel about this retainer fee and the unjust enrichment claim, and you agree that the retainer fee and the attorney-client relationship were governed by contract, right? And so what I'm trying to get a handle on is my understanding based on an Illinois case, Stathis versus Gettleman, was that if you have an express contract, you can't go to unjust enrichment unless the claim falls outside of the express contract.
Yeah, I'll confess that I'm not familiar with that particular case, Your Honor. I can tell you on the merits of the unjust enrichment claim itself with respect to our clients, there are numerous reasons that it can't possibly go forward. Most, you know, the fundamental element of the claim for unjust enrichment is that the defendant is unjustly retaining a benefit that properly belongs to the plaintiff. Here, there's no dispute that my clients, the Brownie Dell firm and its individual partners, never received the $25,000 that was paid to Mr. DeAngelis. It was made out with a check made to Mr. DeAngelis directly. It was deposited into an account by Mr. DeAngelis over which the Brownie Dell firm had no control, and he never shared any portion of that. All of those facts are completely undisputed. They're established by admissions of plaintiff's principal, Stephanie Hill, and by Mr. DeAngelis' admissions in response to requests to admit that we served. With respect to the causation issue, the undisputed facts that the district court had before it included the following. The lots that plaintiffs were seeking to acquire were still available to be purchased at the time that the plaintiffs filed this lawsuit, and in fact for long after. This illustrates that the lots were never lost due to some act of alleged malpractice. None of the alleged acts of malpractice create an uncorrectable legal impediment or bar to plaintiff's acquisition of the lots. Plaintiff's own expert concedes that. Plaintiffs received sufficient additional funds from Mr. Forte in May of 2005 to cover what would have been the purchase price of the lots under plaintiff's allegation, $250,000. They did not utilize those funds to acquire the lots, to seek to acquire the lots. More importantly, they cannot identify what they use those funds for at all. The testimony of plaintiff's own witness, Stephanie Hill, is that the funds were depleted within 2 weeks, and she could not identify anything that those additional funds, which would have covered the purchase price long after the alleged malpractice by DeAngelis, why those funds were not utilized for the purpose of acquiring lots or what those funds were utilized for. They provided no evidence on that. Finally, the undisputed facts before the district court were that there were numerous additional steps, including various departmental, commission, and legislative approvals that plaintiffs would be required to complete in order to acquire the lots. And plaintiffs offered no evidence that they would have successfully completed any of those steps. In light of those disputed facts, plaintiffs could not establish that they would have successfully acquired the lots at issue but for some act of legal malpractice by DeAngelis or the Brown Udell firm, and summary judgment was proper. Now, in their briefs, plaintiffs alluded to a variety of alleged errors by the district court. A review of the record and the district court's opinion, however, demonstrate that the district court did not err. Plaintiffs contended in their brief that the facts on which the district court relied in granting summary judgment were, quote unquote, actually disputed. In their brief, they did not, and today before you, Mr. Tobin did not identify any genuinely disputed material facts. And a review of the party's Rule 56 statements and responses demonstrate that none exist that are germane to the district court's summary judgment ruling. Plaintiffs also made much in their briefs that the district court allegedly failed to consider plaintiffs' contention that DeAngelis had submitted the application to the wrong department, quote-unquote, wrong department. It's a pretty thin read on which they make that argument, but even if you assume that it was factually correct, it simply ignores the district court's actual opinion. The district court specifically considered plaintiff's wrong department argument and explained why it had no bearing on the causation issue. At page 8 of its opinion, the district court stated, plaintiff's contention that DeAngelis submitted the application to the wrong department is irrelevant, as plaintiffs have not pointed to evidence that they would have successfully completed the acquisition of the lots through any city program. And at the summary judgment stage, it was plaintiff's burden to bring forth evidence that would have demonstrated that issue of causation. Plaintiffs also contend that DeAngelis' submission of the wrong department caused their investors to abandon them and flee, in the words that Mr. Tobin used this morning. First of all, Mr. Tobin describes that as undisputed. The record simply doesn't support it. It's not supported by competent evidence in the record. All that they cite for that is a couple of very vague statements from Ms. Hill and one of her colleagues, Mr. Jones, that because of issues with the project, investors said goodbye or something to that effect. What's telling here is that Mr. Forte is the only investor who was still around at that time who was specifically identified by the plaintiffs. We don't know who these other alleged investors are. Mr. Forte was deposed in this case. Mr. Forte testified. Mr. Forte is involved in funding this litigation on behalf of plaintiffs. If you look at plaintiffs' Rule 56 statement and their cites for why investors left, tellingly absent from that is any citation to Mr. Forte's deposition testimony. They also do not provide any affidavit from Mr. Forte. This is very telling, particularly in light of the fact that Mr. Forte is the individual whose $250,000 in May of 2005 disappeared within 2 weeks without any explanation. Even if the investors had, even if there was factual support for the notion that the investors abandoned the project because DeAngelis had applied to the wrong department, that does not alter the fact that there was no legal impediment to the transaction, that was caused by DeAngelis' conduct, and Mitchell teaches us that that's what's required under Illinois law. And finally, plaintiff's investor abandonment argument fails, again, because they haven't brought forth any evidence that even if there had been no malpractice, even if their investors had stayed in place, even if they had more than ample funding to complete this project, there are numerous other steps that needed to be completed before the lots could be acquired, including the various departmental, commission, and legislative approvals. And plaintiffs did not bring forth any evidence that they would have been able to successfully complete any of those steps. It seems in that regard that they did this in their briefs a little bit, and Mr. Tobin did it again this morning. They seem to be hanging their hat on the fact that Alderman Dorothy Coleman, who they have accused of being engaged in an active scheme to defraud them, that because of her support, the project would have been able to go through, and that the district court somehow ignored Ms. Coleman's testimony. Again, that's belied by the district court's actual opinion, where he specifically addressed Ms. Coleman's testimony and explained why it was inadequate. Her vague statements of support did not come anywhere close to being sufficient to create a tribal issue of fact as to whether plaintiffs would have been able to successfully complete the remaining steps in the transaction. In summary, the district court's ruling with respect to causation was based on the proper application of Illinois law to undisputed facts, and the purported errors identified by plaintiffs are illusory. Accordingly, this court should affirm the district court's summary judgment ruling on plaintiffs' legal malpractice claims. I thank the court for its time this morning.
Mm-hmm.
Thank you, Mr. Redberg. Mr. Kopecky.
Good morning, Your Honors. Jim Kopecky on behalf of John DeAngelis. I'd like to first address Judge Williams, a question that I believe you asked the plaintiff's attorneys, and I apologize if I don't get it exactly right. I believe you said, why did the plaintiffs continue to pay Flawless and DeAngelis after the first $250,000 was not used to buy the lots? Excuse me, that's not what happened. They never paid John DeAngelis anything beyond the $25,000 retainer agreement. There was an initial $250,000 that Blight sent to Flawless through DeAngelis' trust account, pursuant to, as Judge Dow found, a letter of direction from plaintiff to DeAngelis saying, I'm sending you $270,000. You should immediately transfer that to Flawless. Blythe had entered into an agreement with Flawless prior to Mr. DeAngelis' involvement, completely prior. The second $250,000 that has been talked about a little bit here, Mr. Redberg addressed, that never went to DeAngelis or to Flawless. We don't know what happened to that. That was given by Mr. Forte to Ms. Hill in May of 2006, and Ms. Hill cannot tell us what happened to that. And Judge Dow correctly determined that, well, you had $250,000 at the time of the first application, you had $250,000 at the time of the second application, so whatever happened in the first $250,000 did not create a legal impediment to the application process, the second $250,000. Excuse me. But just so we're clear, Mr. DeAngelis was never paid anything beyond that $25,000 retainer and was never involved in any other transfer other than the first $250,000 that he did at the direction of Ms. Hill. Beyond that, I honestly was hoping to have something more of value to add here today. Mr. Tobin and Mr. Redberg certainly covered all the arguments. I wanted to be here because most of the allegations of specific wrongdoing are directed at Mr. DeAngelis. So I want to be here to make sure that I answer any questions that you guys have that may be directed to Mr. DeAngelis specifically. If you have nothing further, then thank you.
Mm-hmm. Thank you, Mr. Kopecky. Anything further, Mr. Tobin?
Your Honor, the defendants keep overlooking a case that we cited to you that would raise the factual issues, and it's the Wald case where they talk about waiver. And that we would have a right at a trial to begin to assert waiver. They suggest we would say estoppel, but it's waiver. And to say your conduct leads you to waive, that you have the right to say we couldn't succeed because you promised us we would. And what the Wald Court said, that under those circumstances, that if the minds differ as to whether waiver will be imposed, it does create a question of fact. And the fact, as I mentioned earlier, was the conduct, the promises, and the fact we had hired people who could successfully see this through. I do think that's a question that's in dispute. The other issue was with the 250 transfer the counsel just talked about, it is undisputed that Professor Gross testified that was malpractice. Whether they received additional funds afterwards does not stop the loss that they sustained as a direct result of undisputed malpractice at this time. In addition, Judge, you talked about there's no evidence that the investors fled. That's not accurate. Hill testified that they left. Hill testified she took them around and that they expressed their dissatisfaction. She testified one of them was named Mr. White. The fact the defendants didn't ask the remaining names of the investors does not create an inference against us. So it is clear that at least based on this evidence, I think the court has to take a look at the conduct that occurred here. It was egregious. It was very bad legal malpractice. The Illinois courts would want to see this addressed. It is the type of case that they would allow to go forward. The issues as to causation is exactly what they talk about, that these are issues where reasonable minds could differ because of the evidence we could marshal based on the conduct. Thank you, sir.
Mm-hmm. Thank you very much, counsel. The case is taken under advisement.